Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to today's event on CyberCash's important new book, The Living Presidency, an Originalist Argument Against Its Ever-Expanding Powers. I'm Gene Healy. I'm a vice president at the Cato Institute, and I'll be your moderator today. Now, in happier times, we'd all be physically present at Cato headquarters at 1000 Massachusetts Avenue. We do the event in the Hayek Auditorium, and then at 5, we head upstairs for beer, wine, and hors d'oeuvres. So I would sign some books, and we'd have a great time in the Winter Garden. Unfortunately, circumstances being what they are, you'll have to provide your own refreshments. But on the plus side, on the internet, nobody knows whether you're wearing sweatpants. I'm going to start by introducing our guests, Cy Prakash and Jack Goldsmith. Then Cy will give us the overview of the book. Jack will give us some comments on the book, and we'll take it from there, trying to field as many of your questions as possible. And you can submit those questions through the event page or over Twitter, Facebook, or YouTube using the hashtag Cato Events. Our first guest is our author, Cy Prakash. He's the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, as well as a senior fellow at UVA's Miller Center for the Study of the Presidency. And he's one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars, especially with regard to presidential powers, and the author of an equally excellent previous book, Imperial from the Beginning, The Constitution of the Original Executive. Jack Goldsmith is the Henry L. Shattuck Professor of Law at Harvard, and someone who, as you're probably aware, has seen the executive branch from the inside during a high-profile, extremely tense tenure in the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel during a key early period in the War on Terror. Jack is one of our most thoughtful commentators on the modern presidency in venues like The Atlantic, on the Lawfare blog, and books like The Terror Presidency and Power and Constraint. His latest book, also highly recommended, is In Hoffa's Shadow. It was also the subject for one of the last in-person public events we had at Cato back in early March before the lockdown. So Jack, thanks for coming back so soon, if only virtually. I'm also a great admirer of your previous book, Imperial from the Beginning, but if you'll forgive me for saying so, I think it's one of the most misleadingly titled books in recent memory. It makes a convincing case that in the original design that the framers had for the presidency, that office had very little in the way of emergency powers or independent war powers, and no rightful claim to an executive privilege that could shield its inner workings from congressional demands for information. And, you know, when I initially read it, I said to myself, if that's an imperial presidency, I'll take it. In your new book, you cover and expand some of those themes, but the living presidency is, it seems to me, really more a book about what the office, it's the next step. It's a book about what the office has become and the vast gulf between a comparatively modest office and what the office, has become now, an institution with near full spectrum dominance over American life and law. And in telling the story of how we got here, you point to a somewhat counterintuitive culprit, the notion of a living constitution, which is something that I think we tend to associate with activist judges and left-leaning scholars, who are also, in the main, people who oppose key features of the so-called imperial presidency. So tell us the story of the new book. What is the living presidency? What's its relationship with the living constitution? And how did we get here to this situation that you call a funhouse mirror version of the original presidency? And can we ever go back?
Well, Gene, I'm absolutely delighted to be with you here today, and Jack, and of course the audience. My connection to Cato goes back decades. When I was a summer intern in Washington, I had the occasion to come to some of the institution's events, the Institute's events, including events on farm subsidies. And thankfully, we've finally taken care of that problem. So, you know, I'm really especially glad to be with you two folks, because both of you folks are experts on the modern presidency as well. You both have superb books, and, you know, I recommend them to the audience. There's Gene's book, The Cult of the Presidency, and Gene just mentioned Jack's book, The Terror Presidency. And my book kind of fits in within the same genre. I've got the book over my shoulder here. Operators are standing by. You should definitely get it. I have sort of 4 points that I want to make today, because I want to be brief. The first point is, you know, why do progressives favor a living constitution, one that changes with the time, but simultaneously disfavor, excoriate, lament a living, changeable, mutable presidency? And I think we see this phenomenon all the time. We see liberals or progressives citing what the founders would say about the modern presidency. We saw this most recently with respect to impeachment. Progressives citing James Madison and Alexander Hamilton about what a high crime and misdemeanor is. And that's a perfectly fine argument if you're an originalist, but it's a little puzzling if you're not. And as Gene points out, a lot of progressives believe that modern times call for a modern updated constitution, save with respect to the presidency. And I basically, you know, use the title living presidency to provoke progressives to make them think about what I think is a contradiction between their professed admiration for a changing constitution, but their, you know, soft spot for the founders' presidency. You know, what is wrong with an imperial presidency that grows over time if you can have an imperial Congress whose legislative powers can change over time, or an imperial judiciary whose role over constitutional rights and the creation and expansion of them changes over time? My second point that I want to bring today is that living constitutionalism systematically favors the presidency as an institution. Why? It turns out that if you're going to have constitutional change of the informal variety rather than through Article 5, the presidency is the institution best poised to deliver that informal constitutional change. Today, we expect our presidents to articulate constitutional visions, right? We expect them to be pro-life or pro-choice, pro or anti-gun, pro or anti-affirmative action, pro or anti all sorts of things, including pro or anti shutdowns with respect to COVID-19. Well, they gratify our desires, right? They express constitutional visions, they articulate them, they defend them, and then guess what? They appoint justices and judges that will carry on that legacy long after they're gone. And so when we think about one of the momentous changes in constitutional law, the New Deal, we often think about the justices, but they were really just agents of Franklin Roosevelt, not in the sense that he was looking over their shoulder, but he picked people that had the same constitutional vision that he had of unchecked federal legislative power. And so my thesis is, if you are a living constitutionalist, you are systematically favoring the president in terms of influencing that informal constitutional change. And I argue in the book that there's no single person who has greater influence over the shape of constitutional law, the future shape of constitutional law, than the presidency, right? Not even Anthony Kennedy had as much influence as a president can possibly wield. My third point is that the balance of political forces systematically favors the presidency when it comes to constitutional disputes, or statutory disputes for that matter. As presidents grasp for additional authority, typically to implement their policies or their policy agenda, agendas that are often favored by co-partisans, they can rely upon a bedrock of popular support by their allies in the public, Americans like you and me. If we favor a wall and the president, you know, diverts funds to build that wall, we are going to find ourselves defending the president's actions and defending their legality without regard to whether we really think in our heart of hearts that those actions are legal. And it, this is especially true when the action is in service of a partisan agenda that the president's co-partisans share. And Congress, you know, which is supposed to check the president, is not only divided by partisanship of the sort I just mentioned, but it's also divided bicamerally, right? And that tends to enervate Congress, right? Because Congress finds itself trying to stop a unitary executive when it's riven by factions, party personalities, and by two chambers. And so in the book, I say the presidency is like a fighter jet, and the Congress is like a sitting duck aircraft carrier that moves slowly and that is very ponderous. And in that situation, the presidency is typically going to win. And then my final point is that nothing is sacrosanct about the presidency. If you can, if the presidency over time can acquire the power to wage war, which is basically the power to declare it, if the presidency over time can acquire legislative authority from express congressional delegations, but also through doctrines like the Chevron doctrine, but also through creative interpretive legal interpretations of statutes. And then finally, if the president can essentially, in some respects, bypass the Senate's check on the treaty power, there is nothing that the president can't do with respect to the meets and bounds of Article 2. Anything that you think is a fundamental feature of Article 2 need not be, because with the passage of time and the accretion of pro-presidential practices, what was once thought to be obvious will no longer be with the accretion of these practices. And so you may think that there's some sort of signal feature of the president today that everyone agrees on, but that can be undone in a year or two, or perhaps 10 years. And so, nothing is sacrosanct about Article 2, including the oath, right? Because if we can reimagine Article 2 in various ways, and we have as a nation, why can't we reimagine or re-understand the Article 2 presidential oath, which reads is very specific, but its contents can drift over time and can be given new meaning by new generations. So I'll end with those four points. I do end the book with a hopeful note, with a baker's dozen of reforms that Congress could enact if it wanted to check the presidency. And I argue that this is the perfect time to do that. Why? Because we don't know who the next president's going to be. And behind that veil of ignorance, members of Congress might be willing to oppose the current president because they're worried about what a Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or whoever might do. And so it tries to end on a hopeful note. But again, you'll to get the full thrust of it, you'll have to buy that book. Thank you so much.
Over to you, Jack. I should say, please do send those questions in on either on the event page or over Twitter, YouTube, or Facebook with the hashtag Cato Events.
Ready? So yep. Thank you very much. It's a real honor for me to be here today to talk about Cy's great new book. I read a lot of books on presidential power, and this is one of the best. There are few people more expert, probably no one more expert on the history of the presidency, on the legal constraints on the presidency, and the original understanding of the legal constraints on the presidency. I love the book. I learned a lot from it, but my job is not to praise the book, but to raise some questions. And I have 4 points as well in response to Cy's points. They don't match up completely, but they do a little bit. The first point is, Cy is right that that the arc of presidential power has gone steadily up over time, and it's gone steadily up over time because presidents are in a better position to take the initiative, interpret laws and interpret constraints, and expand their powers. And there's no doubt that I think he's right that the executive branch is ultimately the most consequential interpreter of the Constitution when it comes to executive power, because it has the auto interpretation power. It can interpret its own powers. It can act on that and put the other two branches on the defensive. I just want to say, though, and Cy acknowledges this in his book, but I think it's important to understand, Congress and the courts have gone along with every step of it. Everything he talks about in the book, the rise of war powers, the rise of the administrative state, almost all of it, 95% of it, I would say, Congress has gone along with. Congress has appropriated for an ever larger and larger military, which is what enables the president to use his military powers broadly. Congress is the one that created the administrative state. So this has been and the courts have basically accepted it. Occasionally they push back, but ultimately over the arc of history, they're pushing back at the margins and they're basically accepting the growth in presidential power. So what we're talking about here is the undoubted growth of the executive to a place where it's completely different than what the framers expected. But it's been acquiesced in by all three branches of the government. That's the first point I wanted to make. And it's been enabled because of that as well. The second point I want to, Cy says in the book, whether we like it or not, we live under a regime of informal constitutional and legal change. Though the text of our federal constitution and our national laws may not change that often, their meanings can and do. And I believe this is an accurate statement of the way executive power has gone over the centuries. But I want to emphasize that this is not a recent phenomenon. This is the way that constitutional interpretation and change happened from the very beginning. Cy is critical of congressional executive agreements in the book. These are substitutes for the treaty power. Basically, it's a statutory authorization for the president to make executive agreements, which makes it easier to make executive agreements than the treaty power. I think it seems pretty obvious that the framers thought that international agreements would have to go through the Senate process with 2/3. But the first congressional executive agreement was 1792, an agreement that authorized the post office to make international agreements for international postal mail. Another example is George Washington in the Neutrality Proclamation in 1793 asserted a very broad conception of, implicitly very broad conception of executive power in declaring neutrality in the European War, the European War, and in claiming an ability to prosecute those who violated the statute, even without congressional legislation. There was a famous debate, Pacificus and Helvidius, and between Madison and Hamilton. And the debate is, who knows who won? Everybody has a different view. But the point is, from the very beginning, the president was making very contested interpretations of his own powers to expand executive power. So this has been, my first two points are, this has been going on since the beginning, and ultimately Congress and the courts have acquiesced into it. The third point is, I just want to take a little bit of issue with Cy's claim that tying the rise of executive power to a progressive view of the Constitution and living constitutionalism. I think this is accurate for the most part. I think for most of the 20th century, from the beginning of the progressive era, throughout the New Deal, throughout the 50s and more or less the 60s, it was progressives and it was progressive thinkers who favored the strong presidency, the heroic presidency. And it was conservative thinkers through that period who believed in a constrained presidency, a presidency that was constrained by Congress and intrinsically constrained. But I would say in the last 40 years, it has been conservatives who, and again, there's a range of opinion within the academy, but that's interesting in itself, but conservative governments that have embraced very broad views of executive power in the name of originalism. This got going when, in the 80s primarily, it's too long a story to tell, but it got going in the 80s primarily when conservatives rediscovered the unitary executive as a function of the original understanding, and they embraced a robust conception of executive power as a matter of the original understanding. A very important intervention in this debate was when John Yoo wrote his famous article in the 1960s explaining that the president, as an original matter based on original materials, could use military force without congressional authorization. It was both Bush administrations, Bush 1 and 2, who, under the guise of originalist thinking, embraced extremely broad conceptions of executive power to set aside statutory restrictions, especially in war powers, but not limited to that. And it was conservatives, I think it's fair to say, who were in the guise of Justice Scalia, but others who were really pushing the Chevron doctrine, which Tsai criticizes. So I think it's a mixed story about whether it's progressivism or originalism in the last 30 or 40 years that has really been the font of the growing executive. And I'll say that if you look at the Obama administration, the main sins on executive power of the Obama administration were wielding delegations very aggressively and using the take care power to enforce or not enforce statutes. But the signal position of the Bush administration wielding executive principles, the central executive power principle that they're known for, is disregarding statutes under the name of Article II. And that was primarily based on an original understanding. So I don't think this is a one-sided story about originalism versus progressivism. I also commend Attorney General Barr's speech, which was grounded in originalist principles, his famous speech at the Federal Society last fall, which on the basis of originalist principles contemplated a very broad, robust executive. My last point is talking about reform. And Tsai has an excellent menu of 13 reforms that he proposes, and then I think three reforms which he thinks aren't constitutional on originalist grounds, but he nonetheless urges Congress to consider in light of executive aggrandizement. And I just have two things to say about this, and it raises a larger point, and then I'll stop. The first thing is, some of these proposals suffer from what Adrian Vermeule and Eric Posner call the inside-outside problem. And we can get rid of that jargon. What they basically mean is that the reason we got in the soup we're in right now in terms of massive executive power is that Congress has, for a variety of structural and self-interested reasons, become incapable of governing. They've given away the store. They've given massively open-ended delegations across every conceivable topic. And the president's been very happy to receive those. And so there are mechanisms and pressures behind that that inform why Congress has done that. So the question is, once we get to the reform era, how are we going to have a Congress that, as Tsai proposes, basically stops delegating executive power? How are we going to have a Congress that is going to, as Tsai suggests, basically cut the military budget by 75% if the president uses force without congressional authorization? I think some of the reforms are realistic. I think some of the reforms are not realistic based on the premises of the book about congressional abdication of power. And the last point is, I'm not even sure I wonder what Tsai thinks about this. If he got every single one of his reforms, set aside the delegation problem, if Congress stopped delegating power, that would certainly cut back on the executive. I question whether in our modern government, given the complexity of it, that Congress could actually do that, that we could actually go back to the old model where Congress legislates clearly and narrowly and the president just enforces the law, to the extent that, that ever was the model. But I just think that with every other reform Tsai proposes, even if they were implemented, I actually don't think it would cut back the executive very much. It's basically whittling away at the margins, sometimes thicker margins, sometimes thinner margins. But the reason that we have such a powerful presidency, for better or worse, and some days I like it and some days I don't, it depends on the context. The reason we have such a powerful presidency is because our government and our society have grown more complex, and the structures in Congress have not been able to deal with those. And it's not just in the United States, it's in every country in the world. There's been a massive growth in executive power, massive delegation of executive power. So I'm not sure, and I'm just not sure the reforms would really cut back, certainly not to 1789, certainly I don't even think to before 1937. So I'll stop there. Let me say, those were critical comments, but this is a truly extraordinary book, and I really recommend it very, very highly.
Thanks, Jack. I had a couple of questions of my own, but I think that's a lot to chew on. So why don't we go over to Tsai for his response to any of those 4 points.
So you're not on.
Apologies. I want to thank Jack for his excellent comments and certainly agree with the last comment that you should buy the book. As far as his four principal comments go, I agree with the first and the fourth. I think he's right that it's going to be hard for Congress to overcome its tendencies. And in a book written by a scholar, it's typically not the way that Congress reforms itself. It takes some sort of measure of introspection and maybe some cataclysmic event for Congress to reform itself. Maybe that's the Trump administration, and you know, it's not the book per se. I also agree that there were disputes about presidential power in the early years of the Washington administration. There were all kinds of disputes, and I talk about those in the Imperial from the beginning. But from my perspective, those were marginal disputes. They weren't about, there was no claim that the president could wage war. And I don't think that the Postal Convention comes close to what's happened with respect to the treaty power today in terms of the erosion of the Senate check. And then, you know, Jack's third comment about progressives versus originalists as sort of the progenitors of the modern presidency. I think Jack's absolutely right that there are people who are originalists who think that the founders created a rather strong presidency. I'm one of them, but I think the presidency was meant to be limited as well. And my point is that the modern presidency is transgressing lots of those limits. And so in the book, I do briefly talk about whether originalists are faithful to originalism when they defend the idea that the president can wage war without congressional authorization. And I argue not, but Jack's absolutely right that most of my ire is aimed at progressives and the theory of the living constitution. And finally, Jack is right that presidential change occurred before the theory of a living constitution took root. I just think that the theory is an accelerant to that change.
But let me pick up on a couple of those points, particularly Jack's point three. I agree that the growth of presidential power has been, like many horrible things, a bipartisan mistake. And with the progressives being more responsible in the early part of the 20th century and the last 40 years with conservatives giving them a run for their money. One thing that occurred to me, though, as I was reading the book was, more specifically, what would a living constitutionalist say about this theory? You, for example, Sai, you write that a living constitutionalist, by definition, can have no foundational objection to informal constitutional change. And, you know, I thought, is that right? Saying that the Constitution can, should, and whether we like it or not does evolve doesn't mean you're indifferent to, that all change is sort of legitimate. It may, the fact of a malleable constitution certainly empowers and puts the executive branch in the best position to force in informal extra-constitutional change. But you have a couple of foils sort of in the book, living constitutionalists. One of them is Bruce Ackerman. Another is David Strauss. And you, couldn't they say that by their criteria, these changes aren't legitimate? Ackerman has this constitutional moments theory where sweeping changes like the New Deal, are followed, or the Civil Rights Revolution, are typically followed and ratified by a historic election. Couldn't Ackerman say, well, Truman launching a war in Korea without any congressional authorization was nothing like that. He wasn't vindicated in an election. He left office deeply unpopular. Maybe David Strauss would say, my theory is that it's mostly focused on judges, and common law constitutionalism is an evolutionary, mostly incremental, judicial-driven process, and the president, launching a war is not really what wasn't what I meant at all. So I kind of wonder if you could expand a little on that. And then a related question. You say that there are there's sort of fair weather living constitutionalists who repair to originalism when it gets the political results that they want, and there are also fair weather originalists. You're really much easier on the fair weather originalists. you don't mention really any of them by name. There's one passage that stuck out to me in that section. When it comes to the presidency, it sometimes seems that originalists apply different rules. For instance, some originalists imagine that the founders created a presidency meant to enjoy almost plenary authority over foreign affairs. And it seems that's sort of like a masterpiece of understatement. The Federalist Society is not a monolith, certainly as it's been caricatured, but it seems to me the dominant view is something much more like, if you look at the panels they have on executive power, is something much more like John Yoo. So I guess the two questions, would a living constitutionalist buy this theory, or would they say, no, in my method or my argument, you can't really hang this on me? And why so easy on the fair weather originalists?
So let me, these are great questions, Gene. Let me first respond to the last question about fair weather originalism. And I think it's fair, and I think you and Jack are both pointing to this. Maybe I should have discussed originalism more, in particular originalists like John Yoo. I was thinking of John in that section, and that basically is a section that's designed in part to respond to him. And of course, all the claims about war power are responses to his originalist scholarship that Jack referenced earlier. So perhaps more should have been done there. I have been on these originalist panels on the Federalist Society, and I have, I have views on presidential power that are sometimes quite broad. It depends on the question, right? I believe the president can direct law execution and fire federal officials who are involved in that, and that's an aggressive reading of the vesting clause of Article 2. So, but I ground that, I think, on the original understanding, or at least my understanding of that understanding, and I hope that I'm right, but obviously others can claim that I'm wrong. So I think more could have been done there. With respect to the how living constitutionalists might respond, I think you're right that Professor Ackerman, who's, both Professor Ackerman and Professor Strouth are brilliant. I think Professor Ackerman would say that it doesn't meet all his criteria for legitimate change. And I think, I tried to respond to this in the book, and my basic point is there are lots of people who believe in non-Article 5 amendments. Professor Ackerman has a particular theory that has a lot of steps, and he's free to say that these changes don't satisfy those steps. But most living constitutionalists don't have such a highly structured or complicated theory of constitutional change. And for them, they can't rely on Ackerman's six-step theory. And then having said that, it's not possible to say in advance that these changes to the presidency haven't satisfied Ackerman's steps, right? Because you actually have to do the inquiry. You have to do the hard work that Ackerman purports to do. And so if you look at Ackerman's work over time, he is finding constitutional amendments over time. That is to say, he's not saying I have discovered all the non-Article 5 amendments and this is the universe. What he's saying is I've studied this area and I've learned that congressional executive agreements are now constitutional, or I've studied this area and I think the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is, quasi-constitutional in some respects. So his universe of informal constitutional amendments that satisfy his criteria is changing over time. David Strauss, his book on the living constitution is a wonderful book. I don't think he has detailed criteria for when we are to recognize a change in the living constitution. And much of his description of constitutional change is a claim that the Constitution changed even before certain formal amendments. And so if you look at his discussion of the 17th Amendment, he writes as if the idea of popular elections was partly constitutionalized even before the formal text was enacted. So I don't think that he can say that, you know, no aspects of the living presidency are constitutional because they're not judge driven. I think he has a role for Congress to play, a role for the people to play. It's not just a judge driven theory of constitutional change. If it is, you know, then obviously he's able to use that as a defense. But I don't think that that's his theory. Thanks for that question, Gene.
Sure. Well, I have another question on Trump. You know, it was inevitable that we'd talk about him. You know, we're getting ready for this. I asked everybody if Trump had done anything shocking and horrible in the last half an hour that we needed to be current on. And I don't know if any of us checked, but you have a description which seems to me perfectly accurate as the way the presidency has amassed power. But it occurred to me, you know, as I was reading it, that Trump has not exactly followed in this pattern. You know, for example, with regard to the pandemic, you know, if you had told me that we were going to, you know, suffer an event that would kill many more people than 9/11 and do more economic damage than the 2008 financial crisis, I'd have said, well, there will be a massive accumulation of presidential power. Presidential power tends to grow in crisis. And despite these sort of unhinged crank theories of executive power that come out at the coronavirus briefings, you know, total authority over the states and that sort of thing, where the rubber meets the road, the actual use of executive power with respect to the pandemic has been fairly restrained. You almost don't want to use the word restrained because it's not as though there's some kind of deep constitutional scruple that or Cincinnatus-like virtue that is operating here. But I think you would have expected, you know, ex ante to see a much more significant concentration of power. And Cy, I think, in fact, you wrote a couple of columns about this. How do you account for that? And what do you think is going on there? And with Trump and COVID-19, and perhaps with the Trump presidency in general.
So, with respect to Trump and COVID-19, my sense is that the president's calling card was going to be the economy, and he was going to run on the economy. And given that he doesn't want to flex executive power to order shutdowns of states, because that would make it harder for him to get reelected. And so I think he's forbearing claiming or actually using executive power principally because he doesn't see that it'll help him electorally, right? So it's a weird situation where choosing not to do something increases the chances that the state governors or the state legislatures will keep their economies going. It's still a bridge too far for the president to claim that he can force states to allow private businesses to conduct business, right? So in other words, he's not able to find anybody who will tell him, Mr. President, you not only have the authority to shut down the economy, you have the authority to force it back open. If someone were telling him this, I think it is possible that he might try to sort of seize that authority. In terms of the Trump presidency more generally, this is, you know, this isn't a book about the Trump presidency. I didn't want to focus on him. I thought that would be distorting of the sort of more general thesis of the book. I kind of view the Trump presidency as sort of more of the same. I don't view it as fundamentally different in kind. The president, you know, is sometimes prone to making exaggerated claims about his presidential authority, but that's just in keeping with his, you know, sort of penchant for boasting. But in terms of the actual claims being made, I think you can find similar claims being made across the prior two or three administrations. They may be in service of different political ends or different policy ends, but they're the same sorts of claims, right? So spending money or reallocating money, you know, with respect to the wall has its parallels with respect to propping up Obamacare and subsidizing insurance companies. The attacks on Syria have their parallel with respect to the war in Libya. And so you can go on and on. I think obviously different people complained about different presidents, right? Republicans complained about Obama, and now it's, you know, Democrats complaining about Trump, but the sort of actions I don't think are fundamentally different.
Jack?
Yeah, so I just want to say one thing about Trump, if I could, and then I'll have a question for Cy. I actually, following up on what Cy said, I actually think, I mean, Trump has been bombastic in his claims on executive power. He's exercised his hard executive powers, like the pardon power and the firing power, very aggressively, but not unlawfully. But the characteristic excesses of his predecessors, and his immediate predecessors, aren't his. I actually don't think he has been as aggressive and imaginative in expanding and manipulating delegated power as President Obama was. He is not engaged in disregarding statutes with the elaborate and aggressive theories that President Bush did. He's not followed through on the threatening things he said he would do, a lot of the threatening things he said he would do on the campaign trail. So in some sense, Trump is this really menacing figure, and I do think that he is a menacing figure for many reasons, and primarily doing things that aren't at the edges of executive power. They're things that presidents didn't do because norms constrained them from doing. So I think in some senses, and the emergency power stuff is in line with this, he's been a somewhat more modest president. My question for Cy is, this is I don't know what the answer to this is. You know, the executive power has been growing steadily since the beginning. It took a sharp turn upwards in the Civil War. It took a really sharp turn upwards during the New Deal in World War II, and it's been kind of rising steadily ever since. And as we discussed, you know, this has been in a reaction to changes and making society being more complex. Congress and the courts have got along with it. I guess my question is, what is the status of what is your view on originalism compared to this growth? I mean, you attribute it to living constitutionalism, but it's kind of been going on since the beginning. And so does that mean that originalism is, as a theory, belied by constitutional history, that originalism is a normative theory about the way the Constitution should be interpreted, but it's belied by all of our history? Or is there a way, you know, as you know, scholars like Will Bode have been trying to reconcile a version of originalism with constitutional liquidation through practice. Do you think that there's a version of originalism that can accommodate change through practice?
Well, first, you know, just to ping off Jack's comment about Trump, I think Jack's largely right that I don't think Trump has been as aggressive as some of his critics have suggested. But you know, it's a good thing in a way that people are, you know, push back on claims of executive power, because if you don't push back, it's an open door, right? You just can just push the door open and do almost anything you want. So there's a value in people perhaps exaggerating claims of, you know, exaggerating it about the scope of presidential claims. With respect to Jack's thoughtful question, I think for the first century, there were obviously disputes about the Constitution's meaning across many different questions, right? The bank, you know, the removal power, the scope of the necessary and proper clause, the scope of the Commerce Clause, and whether there was a dormant Commerce Clause. There are all kinds of legal questions, and the answers to those questions sometimes drifted over time. I think that's just going to happen in any system. You're not going to always be able to stay true to the original meaning, even if you think that's what you're trying to do. It's just inevitable. It's like the game of telephone, right? You are conveying a message to someone, and then the message gets garbled in the transmission, and by the end of the process, 10 people later, the message is very different. I don't take disputes about the scope of presidential or congressional power as signaling that originalism was a failure from the beginning. So the fact that Hamilton and Madison disagreed about the president's neutrality proclamation in 1793 doesn't, to me, suggest that originalism is a failure, because I don't think originalism is a theory that suggests that there are definitive answers to all questions, or that there won't be reasonable disagreements, or that there won't be unreasonable disagreements. I happen to think that Hamilton was right. I happen to think that Madison was wrong. And there's a telling quote from Madison years later about his arguments as Helvidius that suggests that Hamilton himself did not believe he was right when he wrote as Helvidius. And then you can go on to other questions, and I think in some of those questions are just going to be reasonable people who disagree reasonably about the original meaning. I think there's a fundamental shift in the 20th century where people are openly contemplating the idea that, sure, the text remains the same, but the meaning ought to change over time. And once you do that, I think it's entirely open to one's imagination as to what those words mean and what we can have them mean. And I give the example in the book of Woodrow Wilson, who was definitely in favor of what he called a evolving Darwinian constitution. But at the same time, he argued that the president should never pervert statutes to pursue policy ends. And he seemed to think it was immoral. And I point out that once you say that the meaning of the Constitution can change over time, why would it be the case that the president could never acquire authority to pervert statutes, right, through ingenious interpretations? And so I basically claim that Wilson was insufficiently Wilsonian in his embrace of living constitutionalism, which is my more basic claim with respect to progressives more generally. So I do think that originalists can be wrong about the original Constitution, and I think that Jack's right that some conservative presidents have wrapped themselves in the mantle of the founders to make arguments about the original presidency that are wrong. And so that, of course, is an originalist argument, and it's being used in service of an expansive presidency. But I still do believe that argument can at least be evaluated, and maybe it'll be hard to evaluate sometimes. Maybe it will be less hard to evaluate. But the claim that the Constitution's meaning can and ought to change over time, I think once you say that, you're basically liberating every single branch to acquire power, including the president. And as I've argued, the presidency is best situated to do that, more so than the other institutions. It's harder for Congress to articulate a theory of congressional power because it's hard for them to pass a statute, much less an opinion defending the statute. And the courts, as everyone knows, they opine episodically and fitfully only in the context of real cases. So I think it's true that there are all kinds of constitutional disputes early on, but I don't think that's a failure of originalism. In terms of Will Bode's theory, I'm dubious of I think Will is a tremendous scholar. I'm a little dubious of a theory an originalist theory which says of the Constitution, the Constitution has an original meaning, but if people get it wrong, the wrongness itself can be treated as if it were right on grounds that's part of the original understanding of the Constitution. That is to say, if you get something wrong long enough, we ought to continue following it. I don't really think there's a lot in favor of that. Madison doesn't himself say this. What he says is, I think that early practices can liquidate into a solid understanding of the Constitution, but Will contemplates liquidation and then reliquidation, right? That as the practices change, it's possible to read Madison as saying that the new practices are themselves going to be understood as an originalist understanding of the Constitution. And I think that's a bridge too far. I don't know if that's a proper reading of Madison.
I want to get to as many questions as possible in the remaining 10 or so minutes. And I want to apologize to the audience out there. This is kind of my fault. I was scrolling up for new questions instead of scrolling down. And to my surprise, I saw a bunch of questions, many more than I thought. So let's consider this a lightning round, if we can. I'll give you, Cy, I'm going to give you two. Here, I think at least one of them you've touched on at least in your most recent remarks. This is from Jack Rakove, if I'm pronouncing that right. If disputes about the extent of presidential power have been going on since the beginning, or at least 1793, as Jack says, does that not destroy the idea that there was a coherent consensus view of the nature and extent of executive power at the outset? I'll add to that one by Samuel Moyne. Why originalism? We've seen originalist arguments on the right, notably John Hughes, contribute to expanding presidential powers. That the left is selectively and strategically originalist may mean we should abandon originalism, not double down. Those, both of those questions, I think, from the main website.
Sure. So to take up Professor Moyne's question, I think that's it's a wonderful response. I think what I would say is that only a theory of fixed meaning has hope of possibly corralling the presidency. That is to say, originalism, I think, properly understood as applied to our Constitution, contemplates that the meaning of the Constitution is fixed and that the Constitution itself doesn't have it the seeds of its own amendment via informal means. And so I think if you're trying to contain the presidency, originalism provides a formula. Whereas once you start with the premise that the meaning of the Constitution can and should change over time, you're of course making it quite possible for the president to change the office that he is sworn to faithfully execute, which effectively, as I argue in the book, renders the Oath Clause meaningless. So I think that originalism holds the promise of containing the presidency in a way that the living Constitution does not. Professor Rakoff is an old friend. I think Professor Rakoff's question is very similar to Jack's. I think the existence of reasonable disputes about the fringes of executive power does nothing to call into question the idea that originalism solves or answers certain questions. Can the president start a war? I think the originalist answer is clearly no. John Yoo has written a very long article arguing otherwise, but he doesn't have anyone from the founding actually adopting his approach. In the face of quotes from Madison, Hamilton, the apostle of executive power, George Washington, Henry Knox, Thomas Jefferson, there's just no one at the founding who thought that the president could start a war because they understood that would mean to declare it. So there are difficult questions with respect to the scope of presidential power, just like there are difficult questions about the scope of legislative power. There are easy questions, I think, from the originalist point of view. The existence of hard questions, I don't think, makes originalism fatally unattractive. I'll put it that way.
Have one from Patrick Subkowski for either Jack or Cy. With regard to removal power, do you think that Congress can ever permissibly place for-cause removal limitations on executive officers? It seems that that would be a way to rein in executive power with a textual hook in the necessary and proper clause.
That's a great question.
Not one this.
Sorry. That's a great question. I you know, I've written about this, but not in this book. It really doesn't discuss removal authority at all. I think the basic question is, what is the horizontal effect of the sweeping clause, namely the necessary and proper clause? And if you think that Congress can put a removal restraint on the president, I think you have to ask, what else can Congress do to the president and or the courts? And my basic view of executive power is it's fundamentally about the power to execute the law, which I believe means the president can control the execution of law by subordinate executive officers and personnel. And I'd analogize it to giving for-cause protection to the clerk of the court. Can Congress say to the clerk of the court, you're going to have for-cause protection and you can enter any judgments you want about who won this case without regard to what the judge actually wants? And if you think you can do that, then I think you can likewise do it with respect to the president. Now, this doesn't seem like an obvious comparator or an obviously good comparison, but judges decide the meaning of the law when they decide cases. And my view is the president decides the meaning of the law as the chief executive of the executive branch. So I think it's deeply problematic to regard Congress as having the authority to impose for-cause restrictions on the removal of executive officers. Now, having said that, the Supreme Court doesn't think that I'm right. And the Supreme Court has obviously endorsed all kinds of for-cause protections, but they've done so in a rather muddled way. Right? They've never really explained why it would be constitutional for independent prosecutors, but not constitutional for the Department of Commerce. Maybe the court will enlighten us in the months to come.
Question from Sam, again from the Cato site. Could the fact that both houses of Congress are rarely controlled by the opposing party be part of the problem, i.e. at least one chamber of Congress is almost always predisposed toward not hamstringing the president's ability to accomplish his agenda? I think you talk about some of this in the book side, the separation of parties, not powers.
Well, Sam's absolutely right. I have a section of the book called Houses Divided, and it basically builds upon Lincoln's point about a house divided cannot stand. And the basic point is that a chamber, you know, a bicameral institution divided by partisanship and divided into two chambers can't stand up to the president or finds it more difficult. And I ask the reader to think about, well, what would, you know, how would Congress's ability to check the president be different if it were unicameral? I think the answer is it would be easier. It wouldn't be easy necessarily, because it would still be a plural institution with many different members pulling in different directions. But it would be far easier if we had a unicameral continental Congress than as compared to a bicameral Congress with two chambers. That's absolutely right.
Question from Peter out in Beaverton, Oregon. Why has Congress ceded so much power to the president, not only military power, but things like trade? Congress has gone along with it, as Jack says, but why has it? So basically the problem of delegation, and why does it happen?
Well, I think with respect to war powers, the typical story that I agree with is that the Congress doesn't want to be responsible for these earth-shattering decisions to send American troops overseas and potentially die in a foreign land. And that explains congressional reticence to weigh in on wars. And, you know, they don't want to criticize the president and find out that the war is a great success or the war is over 3 days later. And they don't want to criticize the president because it'll often be construed as criticizing the troops. Why are you criticizing this military operation when our boys and girls are overseas? With respect to trade, I don't have a story. I don't know enough about the legislative history for trade authority to figure that out. But I suspect it's to give the president flexibility with respect to trade. In an era where they thought the president was generally predisposed to more free trade, right? Trump is the first sort of anti-free trade president we've had in decades. And they gave this authority in a context where they thought the president would be more willing to lower tariff barriers rather than to raise them. And they found out that this president doesn't have that set of policy preference. But the precise reason, I'm not sure I know the reason why.
Okay, I think that's about all the time we have. I want to thank Cy for Jack for participating. I want to recommend that everybody go out and get a copy of The Living Presidency. There is a link on the Cato page, on the event page, to get this book, which George Will says, with this exquisitely timed book, Prakash explains how we arrived at today's urgent need to recage the executive lion. I also want to apologize to anyone out there who didn't get their question addressed. We had a lot of them roll in and weren't able to get to all of them. But please participate in the future. And the video recording of this event will be available on the Cato webpage tomorrow for anybody who wants to watch. Thanks again to Jack and Cy, and thanks to all of you for tuning in.